I saw Birdie. She smiled at me, and at the sight of those tiny little teeth, I exploded. I leapt across the table and threw myself at David. I tried to hit him. Well, in fact, I tried to kill him. That was my main intent. But I was small and he was big, and Birdie, of course, came between us, and I was somehow pulled away and put back to my side of the table. I looked at my sister, at the strange smile playing on her lips, and I could not believe that I had never seen it before, had not seen that my stupid little sister had fallen for the whole thing, that she saw David as my mother saw David, as Birdie saw David, that she was proud that David had chosen her, and proud to be carrying his child. And then it hit me. David didn't just want our money. David wanted the house. That was all he'd ever wanted from the moment he'd first set foot in it. And having a baby with my sister would secure his stake in it. I went to my parents' bedroom the next day. I opened the cardboard boxes into which all their non-valuable possessions had been emptied when the furniture was given away. I could sense my father's eyes on me. "Daddy," I said, "where's the will? The will that says what happens to the house when you die?" I could see the suggestion of words forming in the base of his throat. He opened his mouth a millimeter or two. I moved closer to him. "Dad, do you know? Do you know where all the paperwork is?" His gaze went from my face to the bedroom door. "It's out there," I asked. "The paperwork?" He blinked. He did this sometimes when he was being fed. If Mum said, "Is that nice, darling?" he would blink and Mum would say, "Good, good," and give him another mouthful. "Which room?" I asked. "Which room is it in?" I saw his eyes move to the left a fraction, towards David and Birdie's room. "In David's room?" he blinked. My heart plummeted. I could not possibly go into David and Birdie's room. They kept it locked for a start, and even if they didn't, the consequences of being caught in there were unthinkable. I referred once again to Justin's enormously useful book of spells. A spell for temporary stupefaction. That sounded like exactly what I needed. It promised a few moments of general befuddlement and sleepiness, and small and unnoticeable fugue. It involved the use of deadly nightshade, Atropa belladonna, the poisonous plant that Justin had told me about all those months before. I'd been growing it, secretly, after finding some seeds in Justin's apothecarial chest. The seeds had needed to be soaked in water in the fridge for 2 weeks. I'd told the grown-ups I was experimenting with a new herb for Finn's ennui. Then I'd taken the seeds and planted them in 2 large pots. It had taken 3 weeks for the seedlings to show, and the last time I'd looked, they'd been in full bloom. According to the literature, Atropa belladonna was very difficult to grow, and I'd felt incredibly pleased with myself when the first purple flowers had blossomed. Now I snuck to the garden and plucked a couple of sprigs, tugged them into the waistband of my leggings, and ascended quickly. In my room, I made up the tincture with chamomile leaves and sugar water. It was also supposed to contain 2 hairs from the back of a red cat and a puff of breath from an old woman's mouth. But I was an apothecary, not a wizard. My herbal teas were much loved. I told David and Birdie that I'd been experimenting with a new blend, chamomile and raspberry leaves. They looked at me fondly and said, "That sounds delicious." I apologized to Birdie as she drank hers that it was maybe a little sweet. I told her it was just a touch of honey to balance out the rather bitter edge of the raspberry leaves. The spell had specified that the recipient of the spell needed to drink at least 1/2 cup. So I sat and watched with an affectionate look on my face, as if I was desperately seeking their approval, so that they would keep drinking, even if they did not like the taste. But they did like the taste, and both of them drank their full cup. "Well," said Birdie a while later, as we put a